Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, delivering clarity in a world of constant noise. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers who are shaping the future. Whether you're tuning in live or catching up a little later, stay ahead with the stories that really matter. And coming up on our program, US-SA tensions on the rise as business now calls for diplomacy. Defense funding snubbed again. Is South Africa at risk? Tax deadline is nearing. How to boost retirement savings? And could South Africa be a haven for fleeing Americans? It's Tuesday, the 11th of February. Now, our top story is the Washington-Pretoria diplomatic standoff continues. Kuseni Dlamini, president of the American Chamber of Commerce in South Africa, says there is now need for a mature and tactical response to the U.S. administration's decision to withdraw aid to South Africa following the enactment of the Expropriation Act. With over 600 U.S. companies operating in South Africa, employing more than 200,000 people, the economic ties between the two nations, he says, are significant. And Kuseni joins me on the program. Kuseni, thank you very much indeed. Do you think this impasse then can be resolved, or do you think positions have become so entrenched and we're too far down the line?
I certainly think this impasse can indeed be resolved. This is an opportunity for a reset in the relationship between South Africa and the United States. I think this is a time for more constructive and positive engagement. These two countries, as you have just said in your introduction, are of strategic significance to each other from an economic perspective. U.S. companies combined account for about 10% of South Africa's GDP. We've got over 600 multinational corporations from the United States operating in South Africa. They bring in capital, they bring in technology, they bring in skills. They also assist in supply chain opportunities for small and medium enterprises in South Africa, which employ tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of other people as well. So I think it's strategically significant and imperative for us to prioritize redressing the issues.
And you suggest that all of this is based on trust and mutual respect, all well and good. But do you think that trust and mutual respect actually exists right now, given all the rhetoric that we've been hearing?
It's in times like this, Jeremy, when there's a deficit in trust and mutual respect, that we need to summon our best of diplomatic capabilities and skills, which South Africa is well known of from the negotiations in 1994 and from the roles we've played in peacekeeping elsewhere in the world, whether it's Northern Ireland and some other countries. But I think now we need to deploy our best expertise in diplomacy, economic diplomacy in particular, Jeremy, to be able to resolve this. I think it can be resolved.
It's not just about diplomacy, it's communication as well, which seems to be a key issue. It would appear that many in the United States have simply misunderstood or misinterpreted the Expropriation Act. It would be incumbent, surely, upon South Africa to now improve its engagement, its communications engagement with the U.S. to ensure a more accurate narrative. We haven't done that side of it particularly well, have we?
Yeah, there is an opportunity here from a messaging point of view to make sure that we sing from the same hymn book. We've got a very coherent, compelling and explicit message in terms of the implications of the Expropriation Act. I know that we are all concerned and a lot of voices have been heard around the issue of disinformation and misinformation. I will turn around and ask, what have we done to make sure that we preempt the tendency by some within our society to misinform and disinform the US. And then I think we need government and business and civil society, in particular government, to lead the charge in terms of public diplomacy, in terms of reaching out, using South Africa's soft power internationally to make sure that the right narratives are propagated and advanced.
I mentioned that there are around 600 American companies currently operating in South Africa. I have no doubt that since the pronouncement was made by President Trump in the United States, you have been engaging either formally or informally with them. What have they been telling you?
All of them are very committed to making sure that South Africa and the U.S. have a very strong and positive relationship, especially from an economic and trade perspective. All of them realize the importance of the relationship between the two countries. Let's remember that South Africa is the U.S.'s largest trading partner in Africa, and the U.S. is South Africa's second largest trading partner globally after China. So the business and strategic case for this relationship is very clear and very compelling.
But they also must be very dismayed at the line that is coming out of Washington right now.
Certainly what is coming out of Washington now, it just shows that South Africa is also now has joined other countries that are in President Trump's crosshairs. And we need to make sure that we actively and effectively reach out to Trump and his inner circle of advisors, make sure that South Africa is well understood, because there is lack of understanding of what South Africa stands for, because the Expropriation Act, as President Ramaphosa has said, is really not about land grab. It's really a constitutionally mandated legal process to ensure public access to land, but doing so in a way that balances the interests of private landowners within the constitutional framework.
There's also the thought now of sending a multi-party ministerial delegation to Washington, including leaders from various sectors. You don't think this is too late?
It's never late to engage, Jeremy. And I would argue that it should not just be an event. It should be the beginning of an ongoing process of a holistic strategy to engage with the White House, with Congress, with foreign publics in the U.S., opinion makers, people in the media, whether it's Fox or CNN, whether it is time for South Africa to engage with foes and friends in Washington, not focus on the Democrats who have traditionally been viewed as friendly to South Africa. It's really now about doubling down in terms of building friends, winning hearts and minds within the Republican constituencies and within conservative constituencies. And I dare say this process must be done from a Team South Africa point of view. I think entities like the AfriForum have to be part of the Team South Africa effort, so that we speak from one voice and we clarify exactly, you know, the fact from fiction on this matter.
All right, fair point. But it would also require South Africa itself to dial back on some of its rhetoric.
It's a balancing act that is required in diplomacy. Absolutely, if you want to win hearts and minds, you have to engage in a certain way, and you've got to sort of be careful of your tone and the substance of what you say.
Do you realistically think that South Africa can salvage its position as far as the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act is concerned?
I strongly believe so, and I believe that we indeed can and must do so. I was, Jeremy, part of the delegation that accompanied the ministers, four ministers, actually three ministers, that were sent by President Cyril Ramaphosa in July 2023 to Washington, D.C. to clarify the Lady R matter and also argue for AGOA's extension. And the reception we received there from both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, and in the White House, actually there are more friends for South Africa than foes. And there are many people that want South Africa to succeed, both within the Republicans and the Democratic Party in the U.S. And across the business community in the U.S. and across civil society as well. I think we just need to do the heavy lifting. We now have Ambassador Ibrahim Rasool in the U.S., who is a very competent and highly esteemed diplomat, and he's very familiar with the D.C. landscape and certainly will not be a novice there. He's hit the ground running. We just need to support his efforts.
Well, striking a very optimistic tone, that is Kuseni Dlamini, President of the American Chamber of Commerce in South Africa. Kuseni, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at Midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, in an article entitled How South Africa Can Make America Great Again, Carl Lindemann, an advisor to the Cape Town Interfaith Initiative and a self-described Trump 1.0 refugee, is suggesting, perhaps some might say quite cheekily, that South Africa could become a haven for those seeking to escape what he terms apartheid America. He argues that South Africa should offer refugee status to American citizens who qualify under the United Nations Refugee Convention. This fascinates me, and I want to explore it in a little more detail. Carl, a very warm welcome to you. First of all, tell me very briefly why you decided to leave the United States of America.
Well, again, thank you for having me on. I election eve in 2016, when the results were clear, I knew I had to leave. I knew that whatever was unfolding in America was not going to end happily. And so I started looking abroad, and circumstances led me to South Africa. Well, one of the reasons is that you and I are of a certain age. We're almost exact contemporaries. I should add, as is Barack Obama. And the political consciousness of my era in university was the anti-apartheid divestiture movement. And so South Africa has always enjoyed a special place in my heart. And so when it came time to looking overseas, circumstances just brought me here, in that and this was a natural. The other thing was that I'm used to being in a multicultural, diverse democracy. And so coming to South Africa, it's immediately familiar to me.
So let me ask you this question. What criteria do you think South Africa could use to determine which American citizens qualify for refugee status under the UN Convention?
Well, that is thrown in as an aside. Contrast to very much what Donald Trump threw in by bringing in the, you know, offering essentially refugee status, the preferred status. Obviously, anybody who qualifies under the UN Convention and protocols should be afforded a refugee status. That's simple. Actually, getting any country to accept a U.S. citizen seeking refugee status, even if they qualify under the protocols and conventions, that's quite a statement. So, bottom line, again, according to the United Nations, if you feel that you are under threat, and it's a not an imagined threat, but a very real threat, that you are under attack because of your whatever your identity is, whether it be religious, gender, et cetera, et cetera. There's a list. And the fact is that right now, particularly the first on the list in the what I call the apartheid America, which it was my trying to come some way to communicate Elon Musk's unexpected and sudden role in things. And it somewhat irks me when I hear him described as a South African, when he's an apartheid South African. He left before freedom, and that wasn't by chance.
Carl, let me suggest to you this to you, that the whole concept is a great headline-grabbing idea. But do you think Americans feel as strongly as you do about this?
Well, many already are heading for the exits. So the question is not whether or if Americans are going to be leaving apartheid America. The only question is where they'll be going. And again, they're not going to go, by and large, they're not going to go seeking refugee status. These are educated and empowered people with resources looking for opportunities elsewhere. And why, again, going back, my first job out of university was working in human resources. And there's something that you really learn by being in that environment, is that if you've got a good source of quality people, that will make a business. Your business is built on quality people. And so here is this extraordinary resource of talented and resourceful people that are up for grabs. Why wouldn't you want to attract those?
Do you plan to, or have you engaged with South African policymakers or civil society organizations about this idea?
I have not as yet. I've made some outreach. And I think what I have done on the other side, though, is looking, I mean, the ideal model would be something like this. There's already an organization here that matches volunteers with NGOs. And the idea would be to have a like organization in the United States that would be a tax-exempt NGO that would fundraise to provide for Americans to make the transition to South Africa. And I'm not talking about people who are going to, who are going to immigrate here, per se. They're going to be here until the end of apartheid America. That may be 2 years. It may be, who knows?
Do you think you'll ever go back to the United States?
Well, I've got family and friends there. But honestly, the United States that I left, 8 years ago, isn't the same country anymore. And it feels, it's funny, I identify with people that I heard here after the arrival of the apartheid regime who did not feel at home in their own country. And in many ways, my sense of the United States is that it has been hijacked. And so, no, I don't feel at home. It's a very sad thing, to be honest.
Carl Lindemann, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
President Ramaphosa's State of the Nation address last week laid out his 2025 roadmap, emphasizing economic growth, job creation, and poverty reduction. But once again, there was little or no mention of defense spending, despite its potential to boost both national security and economic growth. South Africa's defense industry is said to be world-class, supplies around 95% of its armaments to global markets, yet our own military remains underfunded and increasingly vulnerable. With recent instability in the DRC, the question remains, is it time to rethink defense funding? Let me put that to Sandile Ndlovu, Executive Chairperson at the South African Aerospace, Maritime and Defense Industries Association. Sandile, a very warm welcome. Let's start with the big picture if we can. Why do you think defense spending has once again been overlooked in the SONA 2025?
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you very much for this opportunity. You know, that question begs an answer, and I think at the moment, no one besides the president and his closest advisors can tell us exactly why. One would have thought with the instability in the DRC, as you've correctly captured it, it would have at least shifted priorities and placed defense at the center of the president's address on Thursday last week. But to our surprise, there was very little said about defense as a priority, other than acknowledging the soldiers' lives that were lost in the Goma uprising in the DRC. So we are quite not aware on why the president continues not to shine a spotlight on defense spending and the defense force as a critical sector for our security.
And I suppose you've got to ask the question, given that you've pointed out that South Africa's defense industry is thriving globally, exporting most of its products, why this success is not translating into stronger local investment in our military?
And we've been asking that question, and we've come up with a possible number of scenarios. But of course, the most prominent one that we are always confronted with is a lack of financial resources for the South African National Defense Force. And we've gone to a point where we've accepted that as the reality, and we've gone back to the military planners and our military leaders, and we've said to them, why do we then not utilize a public-private partnership model so that we ensure that what we produce is first and foremost utilized at home before it can be exported? Because the statistics that you've quoted, as factual as they are, they do not paint a very good picture for us. And it's a scenario that we do not want to continue longer than it has already continued, where we supply global markets more than what we are supplying to our own forces here at home.
Why do you think there's a lack of appetite for more amplified public-private partnership then?
Well, initially, the issue was around the complex nature of the defense environment and of course, the sensitivity of the sector as a whole. But we quickly put all those issues to bed in saying we are not advocating for the private sector to take control of the military. We are only advocating for a more inclusive funding framework for the military. So that has now finally reached the correct ears. That's why you see the minister and the deputy minister of defense have started mentioning a public-private partnership model. The only issue that is outstanding now is for the acquisition agency of the state to define the parameters, to clearly spell out the framework that can then be used to implement this PPP.
What do you think those parameters should look like?
Well, Jeremy, what we have said as the South African defense industry is that, of course, national security cannot be outsourced. It cannot be given to outsiders. So we have said the main one is that the majority of participants in that PPP framework should be South African companies, South African homegrown companies, so that we stimulate economic growth here at home, so that we create jobs here at home. And in a scenario that we do not have the required technology, we have said the state should then put a burden on the South African defense industry to go and source that technology abroad and to bring it back home for localization and indigenization. So that has been the most practical and primary point that we've put across to our military leaders.
If all the levers are pulled and things are moving in the right direction, potentially how many jobs could be created in South Africa?
Well, the numbers that we've crunched have told us that we can create about 70,000 high-tech jobs within the next 3 to 5 years. Now, those are high-tech jobs, and we know that with each high-tech job that we create in the primary sector, there is about 6 jobs that are created within the value chain. So you can take that number and multiply it by 6. Those are the jobs that we are looking to create for high-tech industries, because we know that the industry we are in, the aerospace and defense, is the creator of the skills that are then used to develop under industries. We are talking about artificial intelligence. We are talking about supercomputing, robotics. We are the sector that needs to be at the center of creating those skills that the country needs.
Sandile, the government does put forward a fairly compelling argument. It cites socioeconomic pressure as the reason for limited defense spending. The challenge, of course, within your sector is to counter that argument, saying that investing in defense comes at the cost of urgent social needs. How do you find that balance? How do you make that argument strong?
That argument, from our perspective, is a very skewed argument, Jeremy, because there can be no economic development, there can be no socio prosperity and calmness in the absence of safety. It doesn't happen. That's why all the global powers are very strong militarily, because whoever invests their money needs to be assured that the state can protect their investment. The state has sovereign control over its territory, and it's the military that can allow you to do that. And secondly, whenever the South African police are in trouble, who do you call? The South African National Defense Force. Now, do you understand the scenario that would ensue in South Africa if we had a defense force that was weak as it is currently getting now? There would never be solutions for most of our pressing problems. So it's not an argument that holds any water. In fact, the adverse is true, in that if you were to have a very strong military, we would have a strong South African police. With a strong South African police, there would be a drop in crime, and people would then feel free to invest their money and participate in any economic activity of their choice.
Sandile Ndlovu, thank you very much indeed. Executive Chairperson at the South African Aerospace, Maritime and Defence Industries Association.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
With the end of the tax year fast approaching on the 28th of February, boy, just around the corner, now is the time for investors to maximize their tax benefits, particularly those who dipped into their retirement savings under the new two-pot system. Since the system was introduced in September last year, over 2 million South Africans have withdrawn funds, amounting to something in the region of 43 billion rand. But here's the question: what are the long-term consequences of these withdrawals? And what steps should investors be taking to restore their retirement savings while making the most of their available tax breaks? It's an important conversation, and I'm talking now to Megan Fraser, tax manager at Allen Gray. So Megan, for those who have withdrawn, what are the long-term risks if they don't replenish their savings, given that many people, I guess, are not in a position to do so?
Certainly, Jeremy. So I think one of the most important considerations to make is that the balance in your savings component is generally all that you'll be able to access in cash when you reach retirement. So remember, the full amount in your retirement component must be used to purchase a retirement income product, such as a living or a life annuity. So if you do think that you will need to access cash at retirement, for example, to pay off debt such as a home loan, you will need to ensure that you have this amount available to you in your savings component. So if you have already accessed the amount in your savings component and you are now looking to replenish your savings component, or even if you are yet to withdraw, but you want to supplement the amount of cash currently available to you, there are a number of considerations I encourage people to make and to be aware of. So the first fact is that you will have paid tax on your savings component withdrawal at your marginal tax rate. So this is really important to remember because your retirement fund administrator would have withheld that tax amount from your withdrawal and paid this amount over to SARS on your behalf. So what this means is that the actual cash amount you would have received in your bank account will have been less than the amount that you actually withdrew from your savings component. So if you're looking to replenish this amount, you must just be aware that you will need to look to replenish a higher amount than the actual cash that you received in your bank account. The second really important thing to note is that your replacement contributions into your retirement fund will now be split between the savings and retirement components. So this means that if you contribute 30,000 Rand into your retirement fund today, 20,000 Rand will be allocated to your retirement component, and only 10,000 Rand of that will be allocated to your savings component. So this is important because when you're calculating the amount you will need to contribute in order to make up for amounts previously withdrawn, you will need to make a contribution that is actually three times larger than the total amount previously withdrawn. The last really important consideration is that you will have missed out on the investment growth that you would have earned between the date that you withdrew and the date that you are now making these replenishing contributions.
So the tax year, Megan, is just weeks away, as I mentioned at the start of our conversation. Why now? Why is it important for people to act at this point rather than later?
So one important thing to remember, Jeremy, is that those contributions that you make into your retirement fund are actually tax deductible in the tax year that they are made, which means that you pay less tax now. So at the moment, your deductible contributions are capped at a maximum of 27.5% of your taxable income or remuneration, with an annual ceiling of 350,000 Rand. These benefits fall away at the end of the tax year. So if you have not contributed to your retirement fund yet, and you still have access to this deductible amount, we encourage taxpayers to actually make contributions prior to 28th February to make the best use of those tax concessions.
If I understand this, you have RAs, retirement annuities, and also tax-free investments. Both offer, obviously, tax advantages. At this point, what is a better option for someone who is looking to rebuild?
So a tax-free investment, Jeremy, is a really excellent option when it comes to saving for the long term. So in a tax-free investment, you also don't pay tax on interest, dividends, or capital gains while you're invested in the product. And they're certainly not as restrictive as retirement products, given that you can access the full amount in your investment at any point in time. And this withdrawal amount will not be taxed, as is the case with a savings pot withdrawal. But if we look at the benefits and restrictions of both of these products, we're often asked, as you say, which investment choice is best? So one of the most important things to be aware of when you are building a financial plan that makes sense for you is that retirement funds and tax-free investments are built to fulfill different objectives. And therefore, it may not be a case of making an either-or decision, but rather to consider using both of these vehicles to cater for different needs.
How do you determine the tax deductions for RAs? A lot of people, I would imagine, may not realize that that is something that they can take advantage of.
No, certainly. So if you look at your taxable income for the year or the maximum of your remuneration for the year, and you times that by 27.5%, that is generally the amount that you will be able to contribute to a retirement fund and get those deductions. The really great thing about a retirement fund as well is that if you do contribute in excess of this amount, you don't actually lose that benefit. So that benefit rolls over into future tax years. So it kind of becomes a benefit that you never actually lose. So it's not as important to think about what is the maximum I can contribute, but rather how much can I afford to contribute? And if I don't get the benefit now, I will get it in future tax years.
I guess that given that so many people are cash strapped at this time, people would be tempted to make regular withdrawals from that savings component each year. And that is perfectly understandable. But you'll tell me that this is a dangerous habit.
No, certainly. So I think one very important thing to remember is that when you do take your cash out of your savings component, you will be taxed at your marginal tax rate. And that kind of replaces the benefit you got when you actually contributed. So that's one very important thing to note. The other thing, Jeremy, to remember is that National Treasury's intention when putting in place the two-pot system was to create some level of flexibility for retirement savers to access these funds in an emergency and not to access it every year. So those considerations I gave earlier around what you need to think about when looking to replenish your savings components, as well as whether or not you'll require cash at retirement, are very important to think about before you dip into those savings.
And just a final one, a key issue I understand is balancing accessibility with long-term savings. That makes sense. So should there be tighter regulations on withdrawals, or is that flexibility important?
I think that the flexibility is definitely important, Jeremy. And I think a lot of taxpayers would have experienced some financial hardship during COVID and really realized that access to retirement funds is very helpful in certain circumstances. But what I would encourage taxpayers to think about is when you're thinking about withdrawing, consider whether or not you'll be better off by actually withdrawing from your savings components, or are there other ways to cater for an immediate need for cash? So I think that everybody's situation is slightly different, and I do understand that taxpayers will have a differing set of circumstances and different factors to consider. But I think before you dip into that savings components, really consider whether it is the best possible financial decision for you in the moment. And then also, as I mentioned, look to recontribute to replenish those savings in your savings components in future.
Appreciate the explanation. That's Megan Fraser, Tax Manager, Alan Gray. Appreciate your time. Thank you. And that is our program for today. Back tomorrow with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.